City, USA. It's AcmeCast number 223. I'm Steven.
This is Lord Retail.
And I feel like we just got off a conference call where we experienced the biggest we didn't know we couldn't do that thing in a good while. I feel like that feeling of like, what have we done?
It's like sometimes dealing with a corporate entity, you don't quite know what to expect and you don't really know what their corporate language is. And that's a real thing. Like, we were joking about it, you know, putting our proposal together. And I said, should we use the word synergy? And somebody, it could have been Jay, somebody said that, you know, that's insulting, don't do that. But on the conference call, the guy totally said, he said e-blast.
Yeah, e-blast, cross-promotion.
Yeah, so that's real. People in the corporate world, that's the language they speak, and that's commonplace, so... I feel like I had a chance to say backward synergy and didn't use it.
But the whole thing is going to make for a much more exciting Free Comic Book Day experience. We're doing something this Free Comic Book Day that we have never done before. And we can't say what it is just yet, but if you can put the pieces together, good on you.
And I don't know if it will mean anything to customers and Free Comic Book Day participants, but to us, I think it's kind of unlocked something that is possible. And it will allow us to reach a new audience. You know, I've seen some stories on Twitter and other social media kind of like, oh, it's Free Comic Book Day time again. We got to order all these books, blah, 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 whatever. Just not as into it. And you kind of have to make Free Comic Book Day into not a chore and something that it is your store doing it their way. Like, we're kind of changing up Free Comic Book Day here. And I think it will be to the benefit of participants. But it is not following the parameters of here's how Free Comic Book Day works. Here's all you can do. That's it. You got to think outside the box. It keeps you young.
For me personally, one of the reasons I wanted to do the convention when we did Comic Book City Con was because Free Comic Book Day wasn't the same challenge that it was bringing 2,500 people and a dozen artists and 25,000 books into the store. It just became like, oh, well, this is how we do this, and this is how we do this, and this person knows how to do this. And it just, I remember not feeling completely exhausted and out of my mind at the end of the day and being like, all right, I need something else. I need something to keep me on my toes.
That's thrill seeking. In my world, that's called knowing what you're doing and doing it well when you're not stressed out at the end of it.
Well, sure. But that was, you know, this is... Continually innovating for our own Free Comic Book Day is what keeps it interesting and keeps it fun for us, where it's not a chore for us, even if the customers, I don't like putting on a fake smile when a customer is like, this is great, you know, thanks so much. I don't like being like, you know, gritting my teeth and being like, yeah, you didn't buy anything though. You know, I want to be on a high that day as well.
And usually that's not really an issue, but you know, retail is retail. It grinds on you. It's certainly been grinding on me lately. There's just been little things, tiny little things that have been getting to me lately. But that's a whole other story. And maybe I'll get into someday, if you want me to, listeners.
And something that we haven't brought up on the podcast before, I don't think, but there was an instance of, I'm not going to give all the details, but there was an instance of pet-related comic book destruction in my house this morning. Well, it doesn't happen often, but... It doesn't happen often in my house, but I feel like the number one enemy of comic books is not collagers. It's not moms cleaning out their kids' rooms after they go away to college. It's not fire. It's not famine. It is pet-related natural disasters.
Well, I don't really have that problem, but there was a customer recently who he had some Amazing Spider-Man issues from the past, like 10 years, to get damaged by a pet. And some things you can't just walk out and replace. You know, you may have bought it for $225 cover price, but that was years ago. And if it was a J. Scott Campbell cover or something, that's an extremely expensive book and rare to replace. But, you know, file it under hijinks. You know, you have pets, certain things are going to happen. Sometimes they're going to stand on two legs. Sometimes it's going to sound like they're speaking like a human. Other times it's going to be them destroying the thing that you really liked.
Well, we're going to try to get back into more of a routine here at Acme, and that includes the last Friday of the month being Previews Day here on AcmeCast. And so we're going to crack open the February order book for comics that should be arriving in April. And this is one of those books that we have to pay attention to in a big way, because this is, in theory, what is going to be fresh on the shelves for Free Comic Book Day. You know, this is it. This is what is going to be on new releases 1 week ago, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, is out of this book. This is where we have the best chance to make a first impression on new customers. And getting into Dark Horse, we have Rebels number one by Brian Wood and Andrea Moody. And
I've not looked at this new previews at all, because I have to complete the old previews order, and I try not to have it overlap because that confuses me. I'll be looking through the order tonight looking for things that I've seen in this previews book. But would you say that Brian Wood has an audience, or does he not have an audience but people buy his stuff without realizing whose stuff they're buying?
I would say it's more the this is what I'm terrible at, the former than the latter.
Like, people that buy The Massive by Brian Wood,
they're not buying it because it's Brian Wood. Not just because it's Brian Wood. That's my take. But this is something that Jody said is like Sons of Liberty on the History Channel, where this is going to be like a rough and tumble look at the American Revolution.
Well, there's not...
Yeah.
There's not a lot of comics other than some of Chris Weiser's stuff that even covers this zone, in my opinion. So I think that the content void is there. Is the audience there? I don't know.
And then flipping a couple pages down, one that I was highly anticipating, but now that I see it, I'm like, oh, I need to see the interiors on it before I make a decision, is Archie versus Predator number one, because I would like it to be like Afterlife with Archie with Predator number one. Whereas this cover that they have here is the normal cover, looks more like the Archie versus Punisher, or Archie and Punisher issue that Marvel and Archie did, where in that one, all of the Punisher scenes were drawn exactly like the Punisher, and all of the Archie scenes were drawn exactly like an Archie comic.
It's a strange book. If you've never seen Archie meets the Punisher before, it's a strange presentation. It really is. Not in a this is awful way, but in a that's really odd way. So I don't know. I don't know if, you know, obviously that book's not going to be for kids, but it's going to look like it might be. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what I think of the maturing of the Archie content in that direction.
I feel
okay with the new Mark Waid and Fiona Staples vehicle. I'm okay with that. But this one, I'm not sure.
I feel like most people that ask for Predator comics are kids under the age of 10 anyway.
Because even in today's world, some of the first R-rated movies that kids see or see at a friend's house, it's still Predator, Terminator, Aliens, RoboCop. It's still those things. And aren't all those at one point were at home at Dark Horse, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not anymore, but at one point they were.
And I really don't see a whole lot else, but now we get into the specifics of Convergence, and I feel like people still aren't really understanding that your DC New 52 brand titles, Batman, Superman, Catwoman, you name it, they're all going on hiatus for all of April and all of May to be replaced by these 40 miniseries and this 9-issue overarching maxi series.
And we've tried our best, we've tried our retail best to communicate what's going on either face-to-face with people or through various channels, but there is going to be somebody that says, hey, where's the new Batman? I always get Batman. You guys have skipped me. There's just nothing to prevent that, but I think people do kind of want to hear from us about Convergence in specific, and maybe this will help other retailers too. I don't know. For us, this is a difficult one to order. What we did is we made a little checklist that we gave to people that get anything DC, even if it's just one or two things, and said, let us know which of these you would like to get, because this is all that's available for 2 months from DC. Does any of this sound good? You need to take it home, do research. You need to ask us any questions about it. This is the setup, because you can't really come up with an analog. Like if somebody gets Batgirl, for example, then you can't necessarily transfer their subscription to Convergence Batgirl, which is Stephanie Brown and Cassandra Cain with Tim Drake.
Red Robin,
but not the Teen Titans
version. Yeah, pre-New 52.
Yeah, you can't really transfer that subscription, because you will have ordered something and paid for something that a person is going to say, I don't know what that is, and they're going to mean it and hand it back to you.
I'm not familiar with the writer on that book either, Alyssa Quitney, but just going through and kind of trying to give quick approaches to these books, Ron Mars is going to be doing Batman and Robin, which looks like Damian versus the Red Hood.
I think that's one that people will go for, because that's not, it's not New 52, but it's also the guy in the Red Hood, and it's Robin and it's Batman, so people can kind of recognize that, sort of.
And then there's also Harley Quinn number one, which is going to be written by Steve Pugh, who I don't know as a writer, I know him as an artist, but the cover leads me to believe it's going to be a return to Gotham City Sirens.
And I think that's one that will do pretty well, right? Regardless of how does this fit into the Convergent storyline, just that book and revisiting Gotham City Sirens, which is content that people miss, I think that one will be fine.
Justice League looks like an all-female lineup. Nightwing and Oracle are going to be together, and the Jill Thompson cover is attractive, but I'm not familiar with the artist, Jan Dersema.
Yeah, I think that she goes way, way back to the mid-80s stuff, so she's a known quantity, but you know, every artist that is on the shelf, regardless of their history, kind of has to compete with new artists. But yeah, that one I think is going to be a winner. Oracle and Nightwing, and I guess they're fighting Hawkman from Flashpoint, which that kind of doesn't matter. It's just seeing those two characters again.
And then Greg Rucka had been working on the Renee Montoya story through all of 52 and in backups in Detective Comics and the Crime Bible miniseries and all over DC, wherever he could get a foothold. And he's going to be revisiting that with Cully Hamner in The Question. And then this is one of those things where I'm like, why amongst anything else are you going back to this? This is one of those, this is a One More Day and Moment in Time. Is that what it was called? Moment in Amazing Spider-Man? There was a story that was all about the intricacies of
yes.
One More Day, where it was like, you don't have to revisit this. This is one of the most universally reviled storylines in the history of the Flash. They didn't have to return to Wally West and the kids.
Well, here's the thing to consider. In the macro, they're returning to Wally West, and not the New 52 version. This is Wally West from the late 80s through most of the 90s and some of the 2000s, right? And that's a character that DC Comics has worked very hard to make sure that their readers know that Barry Allen's a Flash. Don't worry, Jay Garrick, don't worry about that. He's over there. Wally West, don't worry about that. Don't ask about it. Barry Allen is the Flash. That's what you've got on television. So why specifically revisit that out of all Flash history? That's really odd.
Titans looks like another one of those things. Why are you talking about this? Where Donna Troy and Starfire are going after Arsenal after he's lost his arm. And this was the storyline where Arsenal's arm had been chopped off, then he beat his girlfriend with an extension cord and then huffed a bunch of drugs and killed a hobo in an alley.
I think while talking to a dead cat, it was a really, and I'm not even making that up, it was a really dark period of time for that character. But they have said that some of this Convergence content will bleed back over into your regularly scheduled New 52 stuff. Do you think that Wally West is coming through?
He's already like, there, though.
No, I'm saying this Wally West, this specific Wally West that has recollection of where he came from, and he will not know what this whole, he won't know what New 52 is because he's not of that place. Is that something they would dare to do?
it would be interesting if there was a spike in the first appearance of Wally West as Kid Flash, or if people would only care about when he took over the costume after Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Because just looking at this content, I can't think of, and this is not in a, oh, I don't like that character, or I do like this character. I can't think of another character that's active here that you could pull them out of this story and drop them in the New 52 that A, fans would respond to or be interested in or would make any kind of sense. Azrael, no. Any character that already has an analog, like Aquaman with Hook Hand, you can't have two Aquaman characters running around. Even though, I guess you kind of did for a while in pre-New 52, I think.
But that Becky Cloonan cover for Aquaman looks pretty awesome. Returning to Justice League International with Ron Mars and Mike Manley, that this is one of those things where it's such a specific creative team that made an impression on a generation that I don't see how you're doing this without Giffen, DeMatteis, and McGuire.
Didn't DC irritate McGuire somehow and he went over to immediately do Guardians of the Galaxy for an issue? So that happened. I don't know where, I don't know the standing of J.M. DeMatteis, but he's there to be asked. He was.
And Superboy has a nice Babs Tarr cover on there, for what it's worth. I think when people think of Louise Simonson, they most often either, sadly, just associate her as Walt Simonson's wife, but she was also the X-Men group editor for a long number of years and the writer of X-Factor for
and
a good
Power
number
Pack.
Of years and Power Pack, and was also one of the editors and one of the people in the room making the decisions about Death of Superman and, like, changed the course of Superman for an entire decade.
Even I forget her DC contributions from time to time. On Convergence Hawkman, you've got Jeff Parker writing it, but you've also got Tim Truman on art, which you kind of want that because he was the artist on the Hawkworld miniseries after Crisis that kind of redefined how Hawkman worked. But all these cool things, to me, are the things that will mean nothing to someone that only knows New 52. Is that customer going to be open to picking up one of these books, diving in headlong and saying, huh, that's interesting, let me learn more about this? Or will they completely throw up their hands and say, I don't recognize these visuals, I don't know these creators, I don't have a stake in this, when they probably do?
New Teen Titans is doing the right thing by bringing Marv Wolfman back for a new story with those characters, but no George Perez. But if it had probably been anyone else, I would have hated it, but Nicola Scott was also one of my favorite artists on Teen Titans. I think she did like 88 through 99 of volume 3 of Teen Titans, so nice to see two Titans creators working together.
I think what you don't want to have happen is, what was that storyline during Countdown to Final Crisis where characters from different places would have to
Countdown
fight out?
Countdown Arena?
Yeah, you don't want to have your favorite version of a character or it's not just your favorite version of a character. These are effectively taking blocks of storylines that maybe people remember. Because it's not just a character being dropped off, you know, in a battlefield. It's like the whole section of town. It's like the whole storyline, all the everything, gets slammed up against the whole other storyline of some other place. You don't really want to have, you know, massive carnage and a place gets totally destroyed. You don't really want to have that. So I don't know if it's going to be aggressive in that way, where New 52 was kind of, you know, other than Deathstroke on the shelf, I think they've toned back a lot of their violence that they had when that initiative just began. So I'm hoping they don't do that, but at the same time, maybe this is a last hurrah where they're like, okay, you can see it one more time, but we're wiping out all of this officially, and you're going to watch it happen. You're going to know that it is gone.
And then I feel like it's been well over a year since they announced Wonder Woman 77 going digital first and now finally in print. But this is going to be Linda Carter Wonder Woman. And I know because we have never kept anything Linda Carter Wonder Woman on the shelf for more than like 2 days. This is going to be a big item.
That is the most evergreen new comic I've seen in years, meaning that a store could leave it on their shelves forever. It should never go to back issue boxes. It should always be available at cover price forever. And someone wandering in to your shop for the first time would probably leave with it.
I'm glad Batman Adventures is going to get a second volume.
We need for it to have a third volume, fourth, fifth. That's what we need.
Which I know sounds a little silly, but DC, much more so than Marvel. Marvel will commit to a thing, and they're not going to stop until it's done. But DC will turn off a paperback series like nothing.
If the orders aren't there, then they will discontinue it.
Just when you thought the Batman animated series line couldn't get any better, they kick up their game with a series of deluxe figures, starting with Roxy Rocket, with rideable foot-long rocket that lights up from the burner.
I guess I thought she was from Superman. I don't remember where she's from, to be honest.
But they're going to step up the price to $40, but I think it'll be well worth it for that one. And then you have the first, I guess not the first, but this is the first other Bat character that they've done for the Batman black and white line. There have been Jokers, there's been Bruce Timm's Harley Quinn, but this will be the first time another member of the Bat family is done, and they're throwing it to Cameron Stewart and Babs Tarr for the Batgirl of Burnside look.
I think that this piece, the statue, will help people to get more acquainted with and appreciate the design of the character in the book now. There's some people, for them, that's not the look that they want, but I think when they see it in 3D, I think that'll make a difference for him.
Now, somebody else brought up with the way that costume works with the yellow boots on the purple and stuff, should they just have done a statue and not done it in black and white?
I think they will. I think it's safe to say that they will.
They'll do that as well, you're saying?
Yes.
And then it's kind of interesting and odd that Disney, who now also owns Marvel Entertainment, who are doing their Disney Kingdom comics like Figment and Secrets of the Weird and Big Thunder Mountain Railroad through Marvel.
Stuff I've not heard of before.
Are instead giving the license to Uncle Scrooge and the boys, the DuckTales or, you know, Donald Duck Adventures, they're giving that to IDW Comics to do instead.
I don't know why that's happening. I think that it could be interesting. There are definitely people that they're fans of the Ducks specifically. They don't want, you know, Mickey. They don't want Goofy. They specifically want Uncle Scrooge and the things that go along with that. So that'll be pretty interesting. Why it's happening, I just don't know. Because Disney and Marvel, they're putting out the Darkwing Duck omnibus. Is that next week?
Yes.
And that's controversial.
Or
because
that's not Marvel. That's like Joe's Books or something
that. Yeah. Okay, so they are kind of farming out some stuff different places. Okay. Yeah. And that was controversial because they're rewriting some details in it.
There are certain things at IDW that you have to get while you can get them. We have the Jack Kirby Commandy Artist Edition here. Wally Wood's EC Stories, the last Wally Wood Artist Edition, was gone instantly. And then, oddly enough, Cordo Maltese. And I think this was a book that we had talked about on the show. But when that volume one came in, it was gone in 2 days, and it was out of print at the publisher. It's gone. So,
you know, like we said, Cordo Maltese, that's a known quantity, especially if you are an artist. So, yeah, that got exhausted quickly, universally. Hopefully it comes back. You skipped over the My Little Pony event that they're doing.
It's also, IDW has changed up the way their page layouts are.
I think that it's natural and it's okay to do a pony-specific event. I don't know the content, but I know it's of interest to customers. And most customers that get this series, that's the only thing they get. Most that are very serious about ponies of all ages, that's the only thing they get. So I think it's okay to do something that goes from book to book and gives them like a, you know, reason to come back to the comic shop every week. So I think that's just natural that they should do that.
I like these Sarah Richard sub covers that are like the ponies with Dia de los Muertos faces on them. And I feel like that's something pony fans will want that don't even necessarily read the comics. How do you think people are going to react to Jupiter's Legacy and that story continuing with a different artist other than Frank Quitely?
I don't know. I would think that they would want the content sooner than what Quietly was able to provide. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm hoping that the content, the writing, Miller's storyline that he lay out is enough to compel people and not simply the Frank Quitely artwork, which I thought was good, but I kind of felt like that last issue wasn't exactly worth the wait. I guess I've transferred all of my Quitely energies to Chris Burnham, who I feel is more timely and more energetic.
Whether we like it or not, the story will continue in Jupiter Circle number 1 in April, still written by Mark Miller with a variant cover by Frank Quitely, but Wilfredo Torres will be your new regular artist on that book. Todd McFarlane will be launching his first new series since Haunt.
That sounds right.
With Savior number 1, co-written by Brian Holguin, and with art by Clayton Crane. And I think there's already several issues of this in the can, so it should come out pretty much on time. And Sex Criminals is going to be taking a bit of hiatus because we're going to have Howard the Duck number 1 in March, written by Chip Zdarsky. He's also going to be writing, there's some other Marvel book that I think he's writing. And then he'll also be writing Captara number 1 with art by Kagan McLeod for Image.
When is it too much for Chip Zdarsky? When is he doing too many things? Like, in all seriousness, I don't know. Because, you know, he came from independent comics, like, for a long time, just sort of doing that type of thing at his own pace. But, you know, he's front and center now. So at what point does he kind of have to say, okay, I'm able to do this much content successfully?
I don't know. He seems like somebody with a lot of
energy.
Yeah. Maybe a little too much time on his hands. And the Wicked and Divine is going to get into the apparel game with the Lucifer Died for Our Sins shirts in white and black. And I'm excited because next week our Southern Bastards t-shirts are coming in. Our Boss Barbecue and Sweet Tea t-shirts that'll be available at Acme Comics Presents. And jumping into our Marvel Comics supplemental, I feel like people are just getting used to the idea that Inhuman as a title is something you should be watching. And we've known that for a while because of the movie. As soon as they announced that, obviously the Inhumans are going to be a big deal. Obviously there's an aspect of this in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. right now. But is it too early to do an Inhuman special in a new storyline for Inhuman and Uncanny Inhumans all at the same time?
And if you would have told me 10 or even 15 years ago there's going to be two Inhumans ongoing series, then I would have not believed that at all, because they're such obscure characters, and even the very best of them, the most well-known, they're supporting cast to other characters at best. But Marvel's really investing in the content and what the characters mean, and I guess they're here to stay. But just yesterday, a guy that is a regular weekly customer was looking at our backstock for an Inhuman number 1 when it was on the shelf at cover price, and I know that he saw it, you know, months and months ago. But only now did he kind of want to see if we had one, and we didn't, of course.
But it's also going to follow the structure of Avengers and New Avengers, All New X-Men and Uncanny X-Men, where you're going to have one team of Inhumans, Medusa and her Kingdom of New Atalan, and the Inhuman book like you've had from the beginning, and then what Black Bolt and Maximus are up to in their own book in Uncanny Inhuman.
It's just a matter of, will people realize what's going on in time? You know, I've noticed more and more and more that I think that the time in which it takes for people to figure out that something is happening that they're interested in, it's widened. And sometimes by the time the interest is shown, decisions have already been made as far as, you know, how many copies are we carrying? Or Marvel's deciding, are we going to keep this book going or are we turning it off? So, I don't know, I'm just hoping that there'll be a little bit more plugging in to say, okay, let me take 20 minutes today and see what's going on in the world of comics, what's coming up, just so I'm in the right places. That's all it really takes.
And I feel like one of the most under-ordered books of the last decade will most likely be Star Wars Kanan, The Last Padawan. This is a story about a character who's in the current Star Wars Rebels TV show, which I think airs on Cartoon Network. This is a prequel to that. But for people doing the ordering for comic book stores, I feel like they're going to be like, I don't know who this is. No one else is going to know who this is. This looks like prequel stuff. I don't want it.
You're right. This is going to be the most underordered book, and this will be the book that people are going to want. You know, if you talk to anyone under the age of, 16, that likes Star Wars, they're going to know who that guy is. They're going to, you know, have as much familiarity with him, if not more, than, you know, with Han Solo and other characters. So this is one of those cases where Star Wars fans are going to, you know, Darth Vader, we know what that is. Prince Slave, we know what that is. This other guy, we don't know what that is. So we're not really going to, we thought nobody wanted it either, which is not true. So calling it right now, Kanan the Last Padawan, that's the book for Star Wars.
It's interesting to see as we get closer to Secret Wars, people that were trying to play it cool on Avengers and New Avengers now can't avoid it, as seen by we sold out of New Avengers yesterday. When's the last time we sold out of New Avengers ever, much less on a Wednesday, but people haven't added it to their lists?
Well, it's the same thing as with Superior Iron Man. Issue 2, sold out off our shelves. Issue 3, issue 4, also sold out off of our shelves, but the pre-order numbers aren't really changing. So that's a case where it's hard to know what to do, what to carry, when you're not really... Not that we're totally beholden to pre-orders, but we kind of are. We look at what people are saying, yes, I want this one, versus I'm just going to try one of these, see if I like it or not. But if you've sort of been sampling about 4 to 5 issues, you're kind of into the series. You're kind of committed to it.
There was somebody who we saw come in, and the first thing they picked up was Future's End, which was on issue 40 this week. And he's like, I'm still sampling. He's got 12 issues left out of 52, and he's still sampling.
And I think that the same thing is happening with Thor. But with Thor, I think the pre-orders are there. But Thor is actual people that are new to comics that don't necessarily even know that Wednesday is the day they come out. I think it's those people that haven't yet discovered that there is a way to reserve things, and if they want to do that or not, they're just picking up a book off the shelf. That's showing that book's doing really well, in my opinion.
I don't know if Jermaine and I are the people to necessarily weigh in on this, beyond saying these are probably going to be the hottest variant covers of the year thus far, more so than Spider-Gwen, more so than any of the Star Wars variants. The Run the Jewels variants for Howard the Duck number 2 and Deadpool number 250 are going to be out of control.
I don't know what that is. I don't necessarily have my finger on the current music pulse at all. But I've had customers inquire about it that I've never seen before. I had a friend ask me about it. He's like, you getting this book? You getting this cover? He doesn't really keep up with comics that much. But whoever came up with this particular initiative, they know music. They know what people are into currently. They knew the right characters to involve. And you're right. That's going to be one of the most popular and sought-after variants. I think that stores are going to have people come to them asking for it, and they're probably going to get annoyed by it. Stores are going to say, what is Run the Jewels? And why do people keep asking about this?
Now, Howard the Duck, I would guess most stores are not going to be ordering. Most stores aren't going to order 50, much less 100, 150 to get multiple copies of these covers. Deadpool 250, which is the final issue, the death of Deadpool, those will probably be a bit more abundant. But
they might be. Not necessarily. They might be.
I don't understand the decision by Marvel to do this as a 1 in 50 variant that's so specific, as opposed to a qualifying variant where order this percentage of this issue and order as many of these as you want.
Well, even if a store could order as many of those Run the Jewels variants as they wanted, what would they do?
But if they knew what it was,
how are they to know what it is? That's not really Marvel's job to say, here's what it is. It's, you know, this, that, and the other, blah, blah, blah. Because when we're in the comic shop, music isn't really discussed. Like, it's just not. The same way that, you know, the latest video game that a customer may be playing that there's going to be a comic book for, but they don't know it yet, but we know it. It just doesn't come up naturally in the conversation.
And then I'm not a fan of when a series changes collection formats before they're done. In this case, Powers still owes us at least volume 7, I think it would be, oversized hardcover that collects Bureau 1 through 12, but instead they're going back and doing a Powers Omnibus that collects Powers 1 through 37, $125. Personally, I don't think this is how someone is going to get powers.
I have no idea how man off the street is going to react to powers. I don't know. Like, comic book fans, especially here, I feel like they've seen it. They maybe get it regularly when it comes out. But as far as people just checking out PlayStation Network and their launch TV show, which that's going to be all over the, you know, if you've got like a PlayStation, what is it, 4 they're on? I'm sure that imagery is going to just be all over you. And you're probably going to click on it if you're bored. You know, assuming you don't keep up with comics, you don't do anything like that. You just want to watch whatever the new thing is that they keep putting in front of you. That's how I watched the, there was some comedy special on Netflix where you turn on Netflix and it's already selected a thing because it's like their new thing. I can't remember who it was, but it was pretty funny. And I watched it just because it was right there. So I don't know what people are going to, what the next step for people to watch Powers is going to be.
Marvel, for the last few years, although it feels like it's becoming more frequent now, is doing these bizarre, oversized, astronomically priced hardcovers. They did the Wolverine Adamantium edition that was like $200, the Avengers Assemble edition or something. Last month they had the Secret Wars box set that was $500. They did a Marvel Masterworks box set that, when all the spines fit together, it looked like Avengers Mansion that was like $500. And now they're doing King Size Kirby, which is really just a random sampling of Jack Kirby stories from his entire career at Marvel Comics. And so this starts all the way back at Red Raven Comics number 1, Marvel Mystery Comics 13, and Captain America Comics number 1 in the Golden Age. It's a sampling of what he did on Fantastic Four, like number 1, 48 through 51, which is the first Silver Surfer and Galactus story, and 57 through 60, which is the first Inhuman story. He did work on Amazing Spider-Man 8, Sergeant Fury 6, X-Men number 9, so it's not even everything. It's just a random sampling of what he did.
This is not for someone reading for content. This is for someone that loves artwork. And I think that sometimes we tend to default to somebody that wants to read the content, know what the story was, know what happened, versus somebody that just kind of wants to look at the artwork. And there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, I think that if you're an artist of varying levels, like, that could be a presentation that you want, you know? Just show me the good Kirby stuff. I want to go straight from first Silver Surfer on over to this book, and then I want to see some... He drew Spider-Man, is that correct? Yeah, I want to see that, too. So that's what I think's going on there.
I talked about the Spider-Verse hardcover last week pretty in depth. Everything except Edge of Spider-Verse that you need collected in there. It's weird that things like the Uncanny Avengers Omnibus are coming out before the Uncanny Avengers paperback, that's not even the final issues of that series. And Star Wars is doing another random, or seemingly random, collection of material from Dark Horse. And this is going to be Star Wars Mara Jade, The Emperor's Hand 0 through 6, Star Wars Shadows of the Empire, Evolution 1 through 5, Star Wars The Jabba Tape, Star Wars Boba Fett, Twin Engines of Destruction, and material from Star Wars Tales 1, 3 through 5, 10, 14, 15, 20, and 22. And somebody was asking me yesterday, what Star Wars comics do I need to read to get ready for the new movie? And I was like, I have no idea. Nothing counts anymore.
Well, the fact that they're reprinting the Mara Jade material, which when you talk about expanded universe, you're only really talking about a handful of concepts that are kind of inflexible. This is what happens next. This is who you're going to see next. It's only a handful of things you're really talking about. Otherwise, it's just, you know, the character's doing stuff. But you're talking about, you know, Mara Jade. You're talking about, it's been so long since I've had to remember any of these names. Dash Rendar, which was from Shadows of the Empire, which is a series that took place between Empire and Jedi? Or it was in between some movies. They
waved it in
there.
He was supposed to be finding Han, I think. But he was all, he was definitely at the Battle of Hoth.
So the
that's
fact
the first
that,
level of the video game.
Like, there's got to be somebody at Marvel Comics that their job is to determine what are we reprinting and why. You know, they can't just throw whatever they want to out there. Yet, I don't know. Mara Jade, that's interesting. Now, what is it going to mean if we sell more Dark Horse content in Marvel packaging than we would have as Dark Horse content? What does that mean?
I mean, I could definitely see that happening, especially in the case of the first epic collection like this that they're doing is basically Darth Vader material with, like, Darth Vader Lost Command, Darth Vader, all that stuff. I definitely think that'll go better through Marvel because some people have the big two blinders on where if it doesn't have a Marvel or DC logo on it, they literally don't see it on the shelf regardless of what it is.
I wonder if those writers and artists get royalties through this Marvel content or if that was strictly through your work at Dark Horse Comics for the Star Wars label. Like, that's a situation, I don't know how it works, when the content is removed from one organization and is released through another organization. Are you still getting royalties, or that was never part of the contract, or maybe they're being nice and they are?
I feel like most stuff, because the Lucasfilm involvement would probably be, and I don't know for sure at all, but it seems like it would be strict work for hire as opposed to royalties or anything. But reinforcing a hunch of Jermaine's, Marvel is going back to print on Secret Warriors and Civil War Miss Marvel. These are going to be deluxe size editions focusing on Avengers Initiative and Dark Reign material that Jermaine believes will become extremely important in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Man, I don't know about Dark Reign specifically, but...
Well, Secret Warriors, though.
Yeah, the Secret Warriors, I think that content's already moving around. All right, we've got to talk about something here. We're already, like, past eight companies. This is what the problem with previews is. You're passing everything.
When did you first become aware of Boom Studios as a publisher? I mean, you would have been doing the ordering their entire career. At what point were you like, okay, these guys stand out from everyone else in this back section of the book? And that was a time because even when I was first doing the ordering, IDW was in the back of the book. They were not a quote-unquote premier publisher along with Dark Horse, DC, Marvel, and Image.
What does Boom have to do to become one of those premier publishers? And if they do they not go to the front of the book before everything else?
Sign an exclusive distribution deal with Diamond Comics?
It's got to be a matter of time because, you know, just the power of the Adventure Time and those other things, that's got to get their numbers up there.
I had said around this time last year, by the end of the year, Boom will be bigger than Dark Horse. They will have a bigger market share. And I think when we looked at the final numbers for last year, Boom was 0.13% from overtaking Dark Horse.
They just needed one more thing. And it looks like they follow the same model as far as IDW. You know, you get some licensed stuff that's known quantities that people like, that people will support. And you also have, like, IDW lean more towards horror stuff. Would you say that Boom tends to lean more towards not a lot of sci-fi, but also, what would you call it? Like, it's not, I don't want to say spy stuff, but there's something with an element of, you know, there's something else going on under the layers of your everyday life. That seems to be like a theme that Boom does a lot.
That would definitely be like Empty Man, Woods, Hit.
Deep State.
Yeah, Deep State, Suicide Risk, all of that stuff would fall under that umbrella. But I just wonder, because they're making such a big deal about their 10th anniversary, and, you know, there are probably plenty of publishers that go under in less time than that, but for a long, long time, Boom to me was like, these are the guys that put out the Cthulhu comics.
Like, that Warhammer.
Was it. Yeah.
Zombie fill in the blank, which I think that was part of the zombie dilution that caused, you know, Walking Dead number one to not be ordered super high.
But I want to say it was when Mark Waid was editor in chief, before even Incorruptible and Irredeemable, but when he was doing There was one book, Unthinkable, yeah, and The Unknown, that was the thing where I was like, oh, okay, this is pretty good. That was probably the first Boom book I actually bought.
I got a call the other day from the Archie Comics marketing guy who was going down the list of stores to call and sort of check in with them and talk about the Black Circle material that was going to be releasing. You know, I don't know about all stores, but I like it when a publisher will call me, speak to me, and kind of say, you know, here I am. This is how you reach me. How are things going? You know, I think that for me, that goes a long way. Some stores, they may be annoyed by that, but I don't dislike that at all. So because of stuff like that, you know, we'll put a few more copies of some things on the shelf from time to time, and we will give feedback on how it's doing.
And along those lines, in my plea last week for more advanced preview copies, this week I got 8, number one from Dark Horse. I got Mayday from Black Mass Studios, which is the final order cutoff, or not final order. Yeah, I guess it is. Our initial order is due today at midnight. And I got Black Hood number one from Archie today.
What was the thing? We got an actual physical copy of it. It was a Black Mask book that I haven't read yet, but everybody else seemed to like it.
Yeah, We Can Never Go Home.
Is that something?
Yeah.
Image Comics quality something? Whereas normally we would carry between, 0 and 5 copies?
I mean, I think I put but in now, for 15 or 20 in the order book after reading it. It was pretty good, pretty sharp. Now we'll actually get to some comics at the table for the first time in a very long time. And I think we can easily say that the smoothest sale of the week was The Dying and the Dead number one from Jonathan Hickman and Ryan Bodenheim from Image Comics.
For there have not to have been a lot of fanfare and promotion for this new book, we threw in pretty hard behind it because we believed in the creative team and that they would present something that we could use, something awesome. And even the solicitation does not fully describe what you get in this first issue. This first issue was a massive book. It was heavy in the hand. And you know, reading it on Tuesday night, I found that, you know, like a half an hour had passed, where normally on Tuesday nights, I have to read pretty quickly. I need a short book to be able to read the volume of stuff that I do. And I just kept turning the page. And I didn't know what was going on or what I was going to see next in a good way, in a suspenseful way. When you're watching a movie and you're totally immersed in what the content is and you do not know what is going to happen next, you do not know what you're going to be told next.
And what you get in this is that a man whose wife is on the edge of death, she has a terminal diagnosis from the hospital. They can't do anything else for her. He's approached by basically like a proto-human kind of thing, a proto-human society.
I don't know what it was.
Could be supernatural, could be alien in origin.
But whatever it was, it's something secret. It's something extremely old. It's something that I guess it's what's really going on in humanity. Human beings are not that. Humanity is just some sort of, whatever it is, humanity is not as good, even though there's more humans everywhere. And this man that they don't really want to ask him for help, but they were instructed to by their powers that be. They don't, you know, if he says no, that's great. That's awesome. Whatever. But if he will do this thing that needs doing, then they are prepared to save his wife. And just the way that Hickman presents, it's not just, oh, my wife is dying. He goes through this process, this very, in my opinion, depressing process of, you know, what it means, how short life is, you know, that you're with somebody for not as long as you'd like to be, and other things get in the way of quality time, and next thing you know, somebody's on the way out. But also, they're telling him, if you take this deal, if we save your wife, that may not be what you want. You know, life is supposed to be from here to there. Life is supposed to have an end. If we get involved, something else is going to happen. So what do you say? You taking the deal or not? What's it going to be? You don't know which way he's going to go at all.
And he also gets paired up at the end with a handler to help him make his decision and facilitate anything that he needs. And so that sets up kind of a classic, like, buddy cop, odd couple kind of situation moving forward.
And I like that the main character is an older guy. That's interesting as well. But I think this is one of the better first issues from Hickman. Maybe it's the length of it, that he had plenty of time to lay out scenery and lay out concepts, because you do get some concepts, but you just don't get any answers about that's what that is, that's where that is, that's why it looks that way. You don't get any of those things.
And the other big ticket must-have this week was the Multiversity Guidebook, written by Grant Morrison with dozens of fantastic artists putting this whole thing together. And I feel like the name Guidebook had turned a couple people off. They're like, oh, Guidebook, Handbook, same thing. But DC doesn't just do a stagnant guidebook the way Marvel does. DC, going back to the Secret Files and going back to the Secret Origins series, tells a story in addition to the pinups that they have.
I don't even know where to start on this book. I'll simply say that if your interest in DC Comics has waned, if you forgot what was good and different and just epic and historic about DC brand in specific, this will reignite all of that, just like that. And it's Grant Morrison that does that for you. You know, most people have a love relationship with Grant Morrison, because sometimes his content gets a little too weird, sometimes it falls apart in the end, but the guy knows his material. And I've said it before, he might be some type of genius. I just don't know sometimes. Sometimes maybe it's me that didn't understand it. Maybe it really was obscure and opaque material, but there's something about it where he might be a genius. I don't know. Because in this storyline, the characters in the story, they find the guidebook that you are reading. That's part of the story also. They have the same book you do. And they're figuring out, where do they stand? What are these other worlds in play? And what they show you were things I never thought I'd see again. I don't know why DC has chosen to show that stuff right now. Because you go company line, New 52.
But
New
not, 52, not New 52. Not in the one more day Wally West and the kids kind of way of, like, you never had to talk about that again. Like,
yeah.
DC was keeping it from you.
Yeah, they didn't want you to. Don't worry about what this has to do with that. Don't worry about that story. Elseworlds, we don't use that label anymore or anything. But this story in the guidebook showed you, was it 52 worlds?
Yes.
It was 52 number
worlds.
There
are seven unknown worlds.
Yes, there's seven worlds that we and the characters, they don't know what's there. So I'm thinking that the CW in the Arrow universe is one of those worlds. And that's the fun part, is that it very well could be. They reminded you of, like, this is where I really need the book in front of me. Justice Riders, that Elseworlds story, where the Justice League formed in the Old West, and then, you know, the powers weren't all the same, but, you know, you can kind of figure out who the characters were supposed to be. And that was just a neat story that maybe you read it, maybe you didn't.
Batman DC, Rain.
Yeah, the
Vampire World.
Yeah, the Blood Rain. Those places were there. DC New Frontiers, a numbered place. Just so many things I never thought I'd see again, nor would you think that DC would want you to see these things. That's
Wonder Woman, Amazonia.
That's the key. Why does DC, why are they reminding you of these things when they don't have to? I don't know if Grant Morrison said, okay, I've got Multiversity ready. You guys want to put it out there? And they said, sure. Saw what the content was and said, okay, we can work with this. After 3 years of New 52, we can work with this. We can springboard this, what's it called again? Convergence. Yeah, we can piggyback our Convergence thing off of all this stuff. Put the worlds out there. Do that. Or if they're just letting him have some fun and hoping that lapsed readers will come back, read it, then you're, you know, at the end of May, you're right back to business as usual. New 52 content stuff.
And I was surprised to see how many, because we put out all the other previous Multiversity issues with that, as we do from time to time. And so even though you didn't have to have read those issues to enjoy and understand the Multiversity guidebook, those stacks got a lot smaller or disappeared completely. And in most cases, We're talking about putting 35 copies of a $4.99 book on the shelf when we're ordering Multiversity, and then reorders on top of that selling out as well.
But I think that the right people that would just love this thing, this story would blow their minds, are not seeing it. They're not there to see what Morrison is trying to show you. You know, equally in this story, Morrison believes that there's nothing worse than Darkseid in the DC universe. That is like the ultimate, ultimate opponent.
The anti-life equations sapping the freedom and creativity from everyone.
Yeah, which is what Darkseid wants / has or whatever. And I like that this book drives that home as well, that there's nothing worse than Darkseid. Darkseid's not in the book, but there's mention of him. There is mention of why he's different sometimes. You know, why is it sometimes he is the worst possible thing? Why is it sometimes he's not much different than, you know, Marvel's Doctor Doom or whatever? They cover that. It's just so much content going on in this one book, let alone the whole Multiversity event, which you don't have to read at all. You don't have to. I know that some people, that does not compute. What do you mean I don't have to read the three or four that came before this one book? I don't understand that. You don't have to.
And the first official King Features series from Dynamite kicked off this week with a new Flash Gordon number one and the return of the Phantom. And I didn't have much background about what Dynamite had been doing with the Phantom through any of the other books that they had done, but this seemed pretty new reader friendly to me. Not in a bad way.
The thing that I didn't realize you would have to read is was it called King's Watch?
King's Watch.
Which was a miniseries that had Flash Gordon, Mandrake, Phantom, Lothar, which, you know, that's Defenders of the Earth is what it is. If you remember that cartoon in Toyline, that was kind of a revival in the 80s of those, like, classic characters. So I didn't read all of that. I guess some things happened, and you kind of had to... Well, you read the first little paragraph in the inside of the cover, and it kind of tells you what you need to know. That stuff happened. Moving forward, read the issue.
Flash Gordon, I was torn on. I loved what Jeff Parker and Doc Shaner did on it for their 8 issues, which ended this week as well. But I also like Ben Acker and Ben Blacker, the writers of the new Flash Gordon, and also the creators of the Thrilling Adventure Hour podcast and live stage show. So I wanted it to still be good, and it is. And we were saying when we were walking in on Wednesday morning that this Flash Gordon is like Star-Lord.
Well, you know, I like those guys too. I don't know them from the other material. I read them. They got the tail end of Thunderbolts before it was over. And that's always fun to meet a new creative team that kind of has nothing to lose because they're, you know, series on the way out, so they can do whatever they want to do. But this is John Carter syndrome in that... What is Flash Gordon? He's a dude from Earth doing stuff in space, like fighting an epic space empire with some friends of his. But Flash Gordon was kind of like the first thing. Maybe not the first thing, or is it the first thing that did that? Is that before John Carter or not? Yeah, John Carter is first, I think. Well, let's go to the Googles and find out.
John Carter was created in 1917.
And he's from novels. Flash Gordon is from comic strips?
Yes. Flash Gordon came 17 years later in 1934. No. Yes.
Which, my point is that when you are the source of a concept, such as guy from Earth going somewhere else, doing amazing things, when you're the first thing to do that, and decades have passed, and a billion other things that were inspired by that are doing the same thing, and that's kind of what you're more familiar with, it's hard for that original thing to maintain relevance on the shelf. There's got to be some people that don't realize how old Flash Gordon is on the shelf. And they're kind of like,
they think it's like the Rocketeer.
There? Yeah, they're like, why is that there? That's weird. As they pick up, you know, Starlight or something else. So I think that means that there's so much pressure on the creators to have to make that original source thing interesting and competitive with whatever the stuff like Star-Lord. Star-Lord's the guy now from Earth doing awesome stuff in space. He's the guy, not Flash Gordon. So you have to really work hard. And I think that they did for the first issue. You know, will people that like Star-Lord and Mark Miller Starlight, will they try Flash Gordon? I don't know. I like to think that they would, because it was good. There's action, there was humor, it was good.
And Uncanny Avengers came back this week with a new number one for Avengers Now, and it picked up right where it left off in every sense.
I've not been a fan of Uncanny Avengers for almost a duration, and I haven't exactly been quiet about that on the podcast, but I was curious about this one to find out what the deal with Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch, who they're really related to. Through Axis, you find out through a dubious scene that they are not blood relation to Magneto. And on the one hand, when you're a comic book fan and you're just learning all the stuff, that's kind of cool to realize that there are these characters that bridge the gap between Avengers and X-Men. That's pretty cool. But then on the other hand, having kind of reread some of the source material through which you first find out who they're related to, that's a weird story, and it always was. I think people forget that. I think people forget how odd it was finding out the origins of those characters. You know, they're kind of abandoned at Witch Mountain, Wondergore Mountain, whatever it is, and they're raised there, and it kind of changes who dropped them off, and then Magneto kind of menaces what's her name?
Bova.
Yeah, he's like, tell me what I want to know. And she's like, you're the guy they're related to. He's like, yes, I knew it. And then decades roll on. So reading the source, that was always a weird thing. But Uncanny Avengers number one wasn't bad. There are people that read Axis and they said, make sure I get Uncanny Avengers number one, which we weren't sure about that. We weren't sure if that was like, that's interesting, but every event somebody's first, and that's the book you're supposed to read next if you did Axis. But the presentation wasn't, I was torn on it. You know, the Vision is behaving in an odd way. I don't love Counter Earth, which is it's another Earth. I guess it has the same geography, I guess, but it's populated by animal human hybrids that the High Evolutionary created. Just to say, hey, I'm making stuff, and they're part animal, and they're living here. There's like no people here,
and it's in perfect opposite orbit around the sun,
so that
we can never see it.
Yeah, regular human beings who, you know, even in the Marvel universe, see all sorts of weird stuff. They don't see this other Earth up in the sky and get panicked by it. I wonder if that place has incursions like New Avengers. That's a good question.
I don't think they do.
That's a legit question. Does Counter Earth?
It's the real Earth only.
Okay.
I can tell it's a fake.
But anyway, Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch are there. They're already there trying to find answers about where they come from someone that I guess they feel would know, which is the High Evolutionary. And Rogue has sort of gathered up a very loose-knit team of available characters to go look for them. And, of course, you know, the situation is a lot more than they needed a more advanced team than what they had. They have Vision. They have Dr. Voodoo, Captain America, the Falcon. They've got Sabretooth. Mm-hmm. Am I leaving anybody out?
Sabretooth on a leash.
Yeah, so it's not exactly like the strike team to go to another world populated by technologically advanced part animal people. But that's where your story comes from.
And I talked about how excited I was for the new Casanova story, and I was surprised how accepting you were of what you saw, Jermaine.
I've tried to read Casanova many times, and what's the word I'm looking for? It is, when I say out there content, you know, if you've read Garth Ennis or Grant Morrison, that means one thing, but this is a different kind of out there.
This is like too hip.
It's something where I either couldn't tell what was going on, or what was going on wasn't my thing. But this time, for some reason, the content it was very direct, meaning that there's a guy that is working for another guy, like is his bodyguard, driver, you know, Man Friday, whatever. That guy doesn't remember a lot about his past. He has a mysterious past. The other guy that he's working for, he kind of knows what that is because he's the same way, and they're going to kind of try to help each other out. That was pretty straightforward storytelling.
And one thing that I hadn't mentioned in any of my gushing, either here on the podcast or on the website or on Twitter about this book, is that There are backup stories, even though the main story is by Fraction and Fabio Moon. The backups are by Michael Chabon, creator of The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which is a novel that has fallen way too far out of the conversation in our world. But it is the greatest comic novel that you can possibly read. And that one is drawn by the other twin, Gabriel Ba.
I had trouble. I didn't know where one story stopped and the other one began. But I did figure it out, though. But for a while, I was like, okay, these are totally different characters. We're doing different stuff. Which is not out of the realm of possibility to change gears in a book like that. But then I did, you know, flip backwards and back to the title page to see, okay, this is where the new stuff begins.
And probably the most overlooked book of the week was Vertigo Quarterly Black number 1. This is the final of 4 80-page CMYK-themed kind of annuals or specials that Vertigo has been doing since early 2014. And I'll be the first to say I didn't care for the other ones. I was pretty disappointed. But this fourth one brought it. It was like, hey, nobody's watching. Let's do it. There is a new Sweet Tooth story written and drawn by Jeff Lemire in here. There's a new story by Francesco Francavilla. There's a new story by the creator of Boxers and Saints and American-born Chinese, Jean Lun Yang, in here. This one's pretty packed out.
But it was, I won't say it's too little too late, because there's no continuity between the issues. Yeah. It's just a collection. It's an anthology book. But the fact that we couldn't really say what the theme was, or, you know, sometimes with these Vertigo anthologies, it'll be, okay, these are all time travel stories, or these are all whatever stories. Like, at this point, should they just kind of, I don't know what the answer is. Should they get more ongoings happening? Should there be more miniseries happening? Because, I don't know, sometimes after all these years, people just don't connect with an anthology book. They think to themselves, you know, this is what it costs. Am I going to like all the stories? Probably not. Am I going to like 2 of the 5 stories? Like, what's the ratio here? And it's usually just doesn't connect with people.
We should do a show about favorite anthologies someday. Not right now. But I know this whole time you've been dying to talk about Batman number 38.
Have I?
Well, it was all you could talk about yesterday.
I feel like this Endgame storyline has already overshadowed Death of the Family. Death of the Family will still be a book that people want to read, but years from now, Endgame is the one. Endgame has more longevity, and there's still 2 more parts to go, so it could all fall apart, but it's probably not going to. But Death of the Family will be this weird story where Joker doesn't have a face or something. Do you guys carry that? Versus, show me an awesome Joker story. We're going to hand over, you know, Killing Joke. We're going to hand over maybe the Azzarello Bermejo graphic novel. And you're probably going to hand over Endgame, I think. There's just, in the latest issue, there is so much to consider that changes everything. Just so many, I don't even know where to begin. You don't know if it's a dream or not. I think if they'd killed off a character was in peril, like Commissioner Gordon, like he's in bad shape. And I think if they killed him off, that would have been a tip off. Okay, this is a dream. Batman's hallucinating. None of this is real, so let's just see what crazy stuff they show. But they don't do that. He's in extreme danger. The city is in total chaos, where everybody, not only are they jokerized and insane, you're also going to die within a certain period of time. Like, there's no way out of it. And, you know, while there's so much tension going on, I'm like, okay, why doesn't Batman ask for help? Because his help, the Justice League, they were already dealt with and down for the count 2 issues ago. There's nobody to call that could possibly do anything in any sort of timely fashion. So Batman's at a loss. He says as much. I don't know what to do in this situation, but you just don't read that very much. There's a point where he's running down a lead, and he's talking with a scientist that would have known how to manufacture, along with Joker, what the problem is and get it widespread. And that's actually it's an obscure villain, because he's wearing like this weird like quilt thing. And that's, I had to look it up. It's Crazy Quilt, which is a really obscure Batman villain. It's the guy that Matt Fraction talked about from the issue that he remembered. Like during that...
Talked about it where?
It was the... it was a live performance he did where he talked about, you know, comics that meant something to him, I guess. And that was the one Batman issue he was describing, like the crazy quilt issue at the hospital. Anyway, it's on YouTube. You can find it. But that was a known character. It didn't last very long. But there's a point where that character says, "This doesn't sound like a Batman story, does it?" And that was just awesome to me because it doesn't. Well, what you're being told does not sound like anything Batman can handle, can deal with. And amid all of the weird stuff, and I'm leaving out a lot of things, Batman has to seek out help from the only option he's got that has any type of information, because he needs some information going back further than what he can produce himself.
And looking ahead to next week, we'll be kicking off the Black Vortex crossover, which will run throughout February, March, and probably April as well, with Guardians of the Galaxy and all-new X-Men Black Vortex Alpha number 1. Jungle Jim will join Flash Gordon and the Phantom in the King Features universe, and Nameless number 1 will give Jermaine the energy he's looking for in the artwork by Grant Morrison and Chris Burnham from Image Comics.
I think that was going to surprise a lot of people, probably myself included. I don't know what I'm expecting from it, and I don't know if Multiversity Grant Morrison has gotten me lulled into a false sense of security that, oh, he's a nostalgic guy, he loves comic books, and here's how they really work, everybody. And that maybe he's no longer like the Invisibles and like just weird, like inside out content. He's probably still got some of that to him.
And the last thing we haven't talked about this week is the Fantastic Four trailer for the reboot, the true reboot of the franchise for 20th Century Fox.
I feel like the word reboot gets tossed around so much, but in this case, yes, it is a reboot. It's taking the name of something you know and ignoring everything that came before and saying, here is this thing you've heard the name but never seen it like this. This is fresh. We're moving forward. Ignore everything else. I thought that the trailer was very modern. I thought that you had a good voiceover with Reginald Cathy, who, is he better than Morgan Freeman? He might be better than Morgan Freeman. Can you say that? I think that there is more comics in that trailer than perhaps what we've had in these other movies. You're going to see the Kirby spacesuits. You're going to see some Ultimate Fantastic Four content. Not that anybody remembers what that is. I certainly was not a fan of Ultimate Fantastic Four. The only thing that didn't fit was I felt the name Fantastic Four versus everything you've seen, which is very, you know, modern. It's science fiction. It's the presentation is very, very suspenseful. The thing that doesn't fit with that is the name Fantastic Four, because that's very old. It's very retro. Fantastic Four, wasn't that the cartoon with like the robot? Wasn't that the various fill in the blank of old thing that you remember from years ago? That's the only thing that didn't quite fit. And I'm not saying that in a, you know, that's not like Fantastic Four, it's different, it's not the same. That's not what I mean when I say that's the thing that doesn't fit. Just the logo, the font, the words. The Fantastic Four, it's not, that doesn't line up with what you've seen. It should be called like a, you know, Superpowers or something else.
The Future Foundation.
Yeah, it could be called that, actually.
I don't know. I'm the guy that always poo-poos everything, so.
You are that guy. You are that guy.
It did nothing for me.
I mean,
I'm looking for the way you said, you know, that name doesn't fit. I should feel the same way after watching a Fantastic Four trailer that I felt watching the trailer for The Flash when that leaked out around this time, maybe a little later last year, The Flash pilot. That was like, yes, that's it. That is superheroes, but it's also fun. It's bright, and the TV show has kept that rolling. It's not that nothing bad can happen or they're playing with kids' gloves, but there's a sense of family and a sense of warmth in that show that was completely devoid in that trailer. When they show Johnny Storm working on a car, it's not like, yeah, I'm working on a hot rod. It's like, this is the car me and my dad were going to build before he died, and he never got to see me take my driver's test.
But I think that that's the debate, you know. Is the Fantastic Four a family, Are they explorers? Are they superheroes? No different from the Avengers. It's like, what are they? Like you're saying, you didn't get the feeling that these people know each other and that, you know, they're as close knit as it gets, and they're also all together going to do this experimental thing and maybe have some repercussions from it. Or I don't know, it just depends on what you feel that it is.
I mean, my favorite Fantastic Four are Mark Waid and Mike Waringo.
Yeah, they were all about this as a family of characters.
And Jonathan Hickman. No, but, and John Byrne. And Jack Kirby and Stan Lee. I like the Fantastic Four.
I wonder if...
And Walt Simonson.
If there had been no previous Fantastic Four movies, could this have been arranged in a different way that it would give you more of that feeling? I think that this movie, it has to be different. It has to be different. That people don't think about the previous movies. They don't wonder if there's any connection. I think it has to be very, very different.
I think... I still say, without Dr. Doom and the nebulous Galactus cloud, what did you not get from the other Fantastic Four movies?
Good things.
What?
Good acting. You haven't watched those movies in years, okay? And you were
the Fantastic Car.
You were missing.
That was there.
You were missing.
Silver Surfer. Yeah, was awesome.
Yeah, you could hold the action figure the Fantastic Car that you can put your figures in, and it's the same. Yeah, you can fly that around while you're watching a movie. You can do that. Kids love the Fantastic Four movies, and for that, I at least give them an okay. The kids really liked them, but Reed Richards was awful, and he was also terrible. Invisible Woman, she was there, I guess.
The best Stanley cameo.
The Thing and the Torch were good.
The best Stanley cameo of any Marvel movie.
It was probably the most appropriate. It was. It was the most appropriate and the least people realized what was going on there, where he was Willie Lumpkin, the Fantastic Four's mailman. That was very appropriate. But I think that we will never again, and this is the thing that even the Fantastic Four movie couldn't explain, we will never again see four people steal a rocket ship and go up into space for who knows what. I still don't really know what they were doing. And I know Fantastic Four pretty well. I still don't really know what they were doing.
They were doing like zero-G experiments in the movie. That was good.
I mean, in the comics. I can't say precisely what they were doing. So I think it changes over the years. But I'm okay with whatever it is that stationary is happening, where they go in like the capsules inside of some sort of building to get them somewhere else. I'm okay with the negative zone being the other place. What if we see Annihilus? That'll be awesome. I think that'll be pretty cool.
I think you've got your hopes up too high.
I'm saying right now that there's a possibility that this thing could work out. What does work out mean? That it comes out and like someone sees it? I think there's a chance that this could do pretty well.
I feel like Marvel Comics won't let it. Marvel Entertainment won't let it work out. Well, and by proxy, it's like, I feel like the X-Men is so big now that people know an X-Men movie when it comes out. But I feel like, especially what we've seen from Spider-Man and now this, like the world won't let it succeed because it's not the same.
I think that the world has less connection to what Fantastic Four is than what you think. I know you don't want to think that way, but I think they have less connection of what Fantastic Four is and how it works than you believe. You know, Spider-Man and the X-Men, there's like cartoons, there's all sorts of stuff. As somebody that's from a time when, you know, there wasn't a lot of that stuff active, like just in media, you can not read a single comic book your whole life and still pretty much know how Wolverine works, I mean, certainly what he looks like. But Fantastic Four, I don't think it's quite there yet. You could show somebody the Thing or the Torch, and they might not know what that is.
No,
they might not.
I think they would know, though.
I don't think so.
Maybe not by name. They'd be like, yeah, it's the stretchy guy and the rock guy and the fire guy.
I don't know. It'd be an interesting experiment. We should do that one day in a situation that's not the comic book store. You know, if you're in the comic book store, you probably, you know, you might know the difference between Plastic Man and Mr. Fantastic. You might not, though.
I think you don't even know Plastic Man. I think you don't know Plastic Man is a thing.
Or Stretch Armstrong. That name comes up in the conversation also with lay people. But I think that there's an underdog element to this movie where, you know, the director, he knows that no one is trying to hear from him in his product. He knows that. He knows that the source material, Marvel Comics, they want nothing to do with it. I think he knows that don't know. There's an underdog element where this thing could surprise people. You know, Avengers 2, I don't think it's going to surprise anyone. You have high expectations. Your expectations will be met, probably exceeded. But with Fantastic Four, I think that there's a lot of hoops to jump through to connect to people, and they know that.
I feel like it's already, like, the way the actors talk about it and stuff in interviews, they're like, yeah, we know it's over. We know there's no sequel. We get it.
We'll see. We'll see.
But while we wait for more information on those, and is there anything debuting during the Super Bowl? Like, wasn't that the first Avengers trailer at one point? Was during the Super Bowl?
There's something. There's a new Terry Crews Old Spice ad, but we don't have comics for that, so I'm not sure why I mentioned it. There might be an Avengers thing, although at this point, I don't want to see anything else. I don't want to see anything else. I'm going to go see it, okay? You win. I was always going to go see it. But the thing they've withheld is you haven't seen The Vision. I don't really want to see that. I know I'm going to, but...
While we wait for the big game, in the meantime, you can find us online at facebook.com/AcmeGreensboro, on Tumblr at acmecomics.tumblr.com, and on Twitter at acmecomics.
You can find me on Twitter at Lord Retail. Every Tuesday night, I read a whole bunch of comics, and I'll occasionally talk about the stuff I've read just to, you know, give people a heads up when they hit the shelf on Wednesday morning so that they're not completely... So they don't leave something behind that they might have wanted.
This Saturday, January 31st, you can find us at the Grady Cole Center in Charlotte, North Carolina, for the Charlotte Mini Con, running from 11 a.m. to 4 or 5 p.m. Get there early. Just play it safe.
I'm going to be holding down the fort at the store, but I'm sending means to get myself a Joel Carroll sketch. That guy is awesome. He's on Instagram, at Joel Carroll. And he just does some really fantastic sketches of stuff that I know, like 80s toys and cartoons and things.
And you can find out about other upcoming events, including our other convention appearances for the spring, at our website at acmecomics.com. And you can hear this episode and all the other episodes emanating from the Acme Wave Projector at acmewaveprojector.com. Anthony!